And welcome to the Limitless, the podcast between. This is Jason Horsley. Always hard to say my name for some reason. Is that who I am? Well, anyway, this voice belongs to a body that was once given that name. It's on my passport. So, spelt wrong. I'm talking to Franz Rupert this week about a trauma-based society and stuff. About trauma. Well, it's a big subject, don't need to tell you that, of course. I know that you look at the big picture and the whole planet and the whole species and the state of trauma, and I'm sure we'll get to that because that's been my interest too, a trauma-based world that we live in. But I thought it might be good to start with the particular and the personal. You've also mentioned your own growing awareness of your own traumatization. So I'd just be curious to start with your own development of this theory and this approach that you have, like how you became progressively aware of trauma in your own life and in society at large.
Mm. Yeah, it was about when I was 22. I already was applied as a professor for psychology at a university. And I had a lot of relationships, women relationships, sometimes parallel. And somehow I made the experience, it doesn't go further. It doesn't go further with the relationships. I'm not happy with it. I'm working too much. I'm in the end not really satisfied with my, also I have achieved a lot, yeah. Being a professor in this young age is quite a lot. But I was not really happy, and I was always in a state of stress. And in this situation, I came into contact with what's called family constellations. And by this family constellations, I got some access to my inner world. Right? Because before, also I have studied psychology. I did my PhD in psychology. It was not really psychology in my mind. It was something about correlations, about attitudes and research on something. But it didn't really touch me, not at all. And only when I come into contact with this family constellation work and I did some constellation for myself, I came really into contact with my inner world. And I came into contact with how I was determined, or I was somehow I was programmed, yeah, by my upbringing in a family, my upbringing in such a family. And slowly I continued, I immediately also took it up and worked myself professionally with this family constellation. Later we called it system constellation. And then for me, the door opened to a world of the inner world. Now I really started being a professor of psychology already, but for the first time I've had the impression, now I understand the inner world. With this, what I today call the resonance phenomenon, the phenomenon of that you, as another human being, you are a mirror. You go into resonance with me, and then you are a mirror of my inner world. And then you get access to your inner world. Then you get access to your biography. You get your access to your own life history. And so it was so fascinating, absolutely fascinating. And so first of all, I understood more about the relationships and make a distinction between those relationships in our everyday life, yeah, and those relationships you could call bonding relationships. That's this bonding with the mother, the bonding with the father, the bonding with siblings. And then the question also, is it possible for you to have a bonding relationship with your partner, have a bonding relationship with your own children? And so this was one very important thing. As those who are psychologists or are interested in it, You can read it in John Bowlby's books, three volumes, where he was concluded, he was compiled his knowledge and research about bonding and attachment. It's very important to know this, very important to know that there are bonding relationships. And the second thing was that I slowly realized that your biography and also your bonding biography can be influenced by trauma. What means traumatic life events, traumatic experiences in your life. And these traumatic experiences do something what is very important to know, that normally your psyche, the human psyche, is a tool that gives you access to the outside world. At the same time, it's a tool to gives you access to your inner world. Under the condition of trauma, if you're traumatized, this doesn't work any longer properly. Because, why? Because the traumatic experience is something that is a reality you are confronted with, that is too much for you, that is overwhelming, that is frightening, that is shameful. Yeah. And so if you cannot escape from a situation that threatens you, that puts you under pressure, that threatens your life, yeah, then you only can do something you can do to dissociate from the reality. You can close the doors that let reality come in. It means you can, yeah, then in this moment, you do the opposite of that, what a healthy psyche does, opening the doors, being curious what's going on. But if this is so, the situation and the reality is so threatening for you, then you have to close the doors of your psyche, close your perception, close your feelings, close your thoughts, close your memories, in order, what I then call, to survive. And then you start, from this moment on, you start a life that is not your life, that you, what you like to do, but in a quiet, outgoing way, in an offensive way. But then you start a life in a defensive way. You shut down, you withdraw, you protect yourself from reality. And this is what I call the survival mode. Being traumatized, that means you switch from the living mode, the life mode, towards a survive mode. Yeah? And this is something different. Huh? And then I found out that these traumatic experiences you could have in your biography, they already can start very, very early. They already can start in the womb of your mother. Because it could be that your mother became pregnant with you, but she didn't like it. She didn't want you. She did not want you that she becomes your mother. I have a lot of clients who survived attempts of abortion. Attempts of abortion that, of course, because people then grow up, they were not successful. But this experience of not being wanted and your mother did something to get rid of you, this has such a huge impact on the development of you, of your psyche. And so that means already in a womb, it can be that a baby, an unborn baby, splits off from himself, splits off from his original force of life, force of will, and starts a biography of adaptation, a biography of trying to please others in order to be accepted. First, you try to please your mother. Then you try to please other mother figures. And the same can happen with your father. So it means you do not live out of your own life power, your own creativity, but you just have to suppress what is yours, what is the reference point of your life, and turn the reference point away from you and turn it, bring it to the outside. Yeah? It's not me who is important. It's you, my mother, the others are important. I have to live in service for them. This is the most profound split that can take place very, very early. And this is what I call the trauma of identity. The trauma of identity means from the very beginning, you do not live your life, but you do your best in order to survive in an environment that is not welcoming you and that is judging you, criticizing you, and forcing you to serve the purposes of others, what in the end means, because the others are also traumatized already, to serve the surviving strategy of other persons. I don't know if I should continue. Please feel free to put your questions. Then I can make also a reference to your questions.
Sure. Well, let's stay on this central question of the psyche, because it's something that I've written quite a bit about it. And one of the things I realize about the psyche is it's sort of an everywhere and nowhere proposition. It's the way that we perceive the world, and so therefore it's, in a certain sense, it's impossible to perceive the psyche because it is that which perceives. And so there's almost a metaphysical aspect of the psyche. Of course, it corresponds with the soul. And I've written and researched a lot about the fragmentation of the psyche, which is what you're talking about here. But what I wanted to get to is what's actually happening, because the psyche is a kind of abstract principle, where, as compared to the body, which of course is something that we can measure, and my orientation has become more and more, not that it's either or, but on what's happening to the body, what's actually happening to the nervous system of the infant, the fetus even, and then the baby, and then the child and the infant, that corresponds with the trauma, and that there is the source of this fragmentation that you're talking about.
Of course. I can explain it to you. I have a clear concept in that. I don't know. I don't know, like, to have this wishy-washy about psyche and soul and so on. For me, it's very clear. The starting point of the thinking is the living human organism. Your organism, my organism, the living organism of other people. I do not study corpse. I study living organism. And this living organism consists of material, energy, and information. And this living organism consists of a lot of subsystems, a genetic subsystem, a neurological subsystem, a chemical subsystem, a moon subsystem, a bacteria subsystem, a hormone subsystem, and it consists also of a psyche subsystem. Yeah? And this is what I'm expert in. And of course, all these systems in this living organism have to cooperate. Because it's a system, and in a system, you have the factor A influences factor B, but also factor B then re-influences factor A. Yeah? That is what a system is. And the psyche is a specific system in the living organism. And the main purpose of the psyche is to process information. So this process of processing of information means you start with what is going on, what is in the outside. You perceive something. After the perception, there is something that you evaluate the information. This is what we call feelings. And then you connect what's inside already you, because it's not a tabula rasa inside. You already have something inside. Then you compare the information that comes in with what is already stored in you. That means you connect things. Then you start an associative way of explaining. You make correlations and say, all men are like this, and all women are like this, and all American are like this. This one is a very rude way of getting knowledge, getting insights. But then you realize that this is not enough. It's because it's not true that all Americans are like this and all men are like this. And then you have to think, and have to make conclusions. To be aware of contradictions. And this is then the highest form, in a way, of knowledge, getting knowledge, that you in the end know what you have found out is knowledge that is true for me and is true for you. Because feelings, if there are feelings, they may be all not true for you and not for me. But on an higher level of consciousness, we do have gained knowledge also in cooperation, in discussing, that is then true for you and it's, well, it's true for me, and maybe it's true for everyone in the world. Then this information process of the psyche, this information processing of the psyche also needs a memory. So we have a very differentiated type of memory in the psyche. Then this information process needs a point of reference. And this point of reference we call the self or the I. Then this psyche also has the possibility to make decisions, that you say, I chose A and leave away B. And then this psyche also needs something that transfers the knowledge into action. Yeah? And so on and so on. It's a very complex system, and it has nothing to do with some fishy about what is soul and this and that. This, for me, the psyche is a clear, describable system. Yeah? And out of this system, if I base my research on that, out of this I can explain trauma. Then I can explain what is a psychotrauma and how is the psyche and the body connected. Because as long as you're not traumatized, the psyche and body are just developing together and there is no contradiction. When your body doesn't feel well, your psyche realizes it. And if your psyche is not well somehow, then your body realizes it. And then you can do something to bring this in order again. But under the condition of trauma, if something happens that you have to have with your psyche avoid reality in the outside, at the same time you avoid the inner reality. You no longer listen to what your body tells you. The information that comes out from the body is ignored somehow by the psyche, because, for example, you have made an experience of panic. Yeah, you came in a state where emergency state where you nearly could die, maybe. And then you have to split off this panic, put it somewhere in the organism, and then your mind seems to be free from panic, from anxieties. And then when your body shows you something and says, "Look, there is still this panic inside me. You do not have it processed until now," and then your mind, your surviving mind, tells you, "Oh no, everything is fine, and I should be a tough guy, not showing any anxieties." Yeah, and so this is the reason why to know about trauma is so important, because this alienates you not only from the outside world. You have no proper access any longer to what's going outside in nature and with other people. At the same time, it alienates you from yourself. You have no longer a good connection with yourself, and especially with your body. And so some people, somehow you can say they do have a body, yeah, but they think as if they have only the left brain. That's over. And there's no connection between the body in the body and what they are mentally processing. And this is how I see this. And if you are disconnected from your body, from your mind, then another thing is important: you do no longer act responsible. You cannot, because you don't have to take responsibility for your own life. And then some people, yeah, they go to politics, they become CIOs of some government industries and so, and then they try to manage something and to take responsibility maybe for a whole community, a whole enterprise, but they cannot do it properly because they are not, in the end, they're not even responsible for themselves. They did not take the full responsibility for themselves. And on the lower level, you have this with the parents. If the parents are traumatized, they do not really have control over themselves. And then with this, let's say, traumatized parents, then they influence their children and tell their children what to do. And of course, then you can see, how can you say your children what to do if you are not in control of yourself? and tell children they should be they should have control over their behavior. It doesn't make sense. And so many contradictions. With when you're traumatized, you produce so many contradictions in your life and also in the life of other persons.
I'm high as a kite, I'm buzzing like a bee. There's flowers upon a cherry tree. So come out, sister, and play with me. Nobody knows why he's gone.
So something that is so widespread, as you've articulated just now, but also, I mean, in the model that you've created for understanding trauma throughout society and throughout history, you're describing something that is pervasive and everywhere, it seems to me. So, I mean, it seems as that raises a number of questions. One of which is would be, I mean, if something is so prevalent, then what do we compare it with? What do we contrast it with? I mean, how do you find a model for an individual or a community or a society that isn't shaped by trauma? Is there such a thing? And if not, like, how do we identify trauma as an invasive agent if it's so basic and fundamental to human existence?
Yeah, in fact, it is. I see it like this, and I think that it also has to do with patriarchal structures, that women are seen as objects for men, and also children are seen as objects for men. Women are poor, the men possess the wealth of a country, and the women are forced to get children even if they do not want, if they are not prepared for it. It all has to do with the condition of motherhood, in my view. If there are good conditions for motherhood, then the mothers really can take care, love their children, can be as much available for them, but not forcing children to be in service for them, like traumatized mothers doing. Yeah? Traumatized mothers are forcing the children to be in service for their surviving strategies. So that means all what's for a society, the wealth, the healthiness of a society depends, in my view and in my experience, depends on how motherhood is organized. Yeah? And if the women do have the free choice to have children, the free choice to have so many children as they find good for them, and they find good for being a good mother. This is an absolutely different situation from patriarchal societies where women are married somehow, they are possessed by the man, they are dependent on the man, they are expected to produce children for the man. And under these conditions, most of the women are themselves traumatized because they are traumatized by their mother already. Yeah? Or they are traumatized by sexual assaults, by sexual trauma in the family. Yeah? And so this is a transgenerational, multi-generational problem. Because your mother is traumatized, you get traumatized. And because you are traumatized, your children then are traumatized, because so much depends on this early mother-child relationship. If a human being grows up healthily and is not forced to fragmentate the psyche and disconnect from the body. And so this is for me the crucial point, where you could make a turn a society into a healthy society. And there are, in the world, of course, there are some matriarchal societies that really respect motherhood. They respect the female. They respect them as being most important for a good society. And the men are somehow second important. No? But in the patriarchal system, men believe they are first important. They are the most important. You look at the governments, look at the CIOs, all everywhere. Men dominate the system. They dominate the financial system. They dominate the possessions. And so this is, of course, this is then the precondition for prolonging trauma to eternity. If you do not wake up, if you do not say you do not like it. Because another thing is that a male-dominated system and society is a competition society. Because men, out of their biological nature somehow, they compete. They compete with each other. They compete for women. It's, of course, women also, they try to be beautiful and make choices for it. But the competition, the fight against each other, you see it in the animal kingdom, no? When two lions are fighting, who is more stronger to get the lioness? And so this is, somehow also something maybe that we could decide, do we like competition or do we like cooperation? And I have learned in my biography, I was very competitive until this turning point in my life came, in my 30s then, and I continued with that, and now I'm 63. I learned how much better life I live without competition, without trying to be better than others, without trying to see others as my enemies. Yeah? I always now I see others as a very worthy partner who has to contribute something very special, something very precious to our cooperation and to our system, to our relational system. And under this condition, we grow. You grow and I grow. Yeah? Under the condition of competition, one of us wins and the other person loses. And this is also something I think we have to think about it. By competition, you produce trauma. A competitive society produces ongoing situations of trauma. And when I define in my theory, I'd call it identity-oriented psychotrauma theory and therapy. In my theory, the term identity is very important. And identity means you have to focus in yourself. Under the condition of a competitive society, you always need to look what are the others doing. The focus of your orientation is outside. It's not in you, it's in the outside world. Who is faster? Who is stronger? Who is richer than me? And then you do something you wouldn't do if there would not be a competitor with you. Huh? And so this is vice versa. You force each other not to have to focus on yourself, but you have to focus on the outside. And this is, yeah, this is also something that continuously produces situation that one of the person or both maybe end up in a state of helplessness, of being overwhelmed, and so then in the end of being traumatized.
I was wondering if there's a danger in polarizing there with competitive versus cooperative and matriarchal versus patriarchal. Because, I mean, for example, when you're talking about competitive is about focusing on the other and one needs to focus on oneself, one could also say that cooperative behavior is about focusing on the other too, like you were saying at the beginning, that we have this capacity to tune in to the other internally, like our systems, like we can synchronize our systems like neurons in a brain, so that we're really experiencing our own interiority by tuning into the interiority of the other. And then this allows for this cooperative system to start working. And so it seems that it's not exactly either or. It depends very much on our perspective and how we're defining our experience. Competition isn't necessarily bad, as in there can be, you know, there are games. I mean, I'm not a sport person myself, but there are ways in which we can compete and in a cooperative way, just as there are ways that we cooperate in a competitive way, if you see what I mean. So yes. I was just you know, wondering about that. It's kind of a general question, but also more specifically about whether the root of the trauma is to do with patriarchy, and if matriarchy is the solution. I found myself going round and round on this, and of course today we have this liberal progressive idea that the patriarchy is bad and that women are good, and this isn't helping the situation at all, because it's shaming white men and so on, and it doesn't answer this kind of question that seems almost impossible to resolve, which is if women are traumatizing their children because they weren't made safe by the men, that's because the men themselves were traumatized and not functioning as men. So then they were traumatized by their mothers, and right. So it's still, it never, you know, how did it begin? That question is never answered. If we keep making it about either or, you know, is it the men? Is it the women? Is it competitive? It seems as though it's something subtler to me that's going on.
Yeah, of course, you're right. The traumatized mother not only traumatizes her daughter, but also traumatizes and seriously traumatizes her son. And this traumatized son then again traumatizes others. And so, of course, it's something. When I say it, it's about patriarchal system and matriarchal system, and about competition or cooperation. Of course, this is a little bit white or black, but there is something in it. Yeah, if you allow the women really to make a free choice, if they want to have children, and if they, how many children they want, then this is a condition for being a good mother, for not traumatizing your daughters and not traumatizing your sons. This could be a starting point. Yeah? However you start with it, the most important thing, do it. Start with it. Make the conditions for mothers like this that they can be in a way in a good service for their children. Don't force, for example, mothers to be on work immediately after birth or of some weeks after birth, giving their children in foster care, giving their children in kinder crèches, children crèche, and so on. This is the best way to traumatize your children. Yeah, and so there are many, for me, there are many points in a society where you could say, okay, this is a traumatizing situation. This is a traumatizing situation maybe for a whole generation. This is a traumatizing situation for the man. This is a traumatizing situation for example, war, yeah? Or is this a traumatizing situation for women being forced marriage and so? And then in a society to try to avoid everything we can do not to produce trauma, not to produce systematically trauma, yeah? The moment, this is the moment if we are able to identify what is a traumatizing situation, yeah? and then saying, okay, what can we do to avoid such traumatizing situation? A huge step forward would be made. Yeah? And that means, for me, a trauma-sensitive society, a sensitive society that is different from the society you have today. These societies we do have worldwide, and I'm working worldwide, I'm traveling in many, many countries. The societies we do have today are trauma-blind societies. They are ignoring society, they're ignoring traumas. They are focusing on anything else, but not on the human psyche and not on the psychotrauma. This is at the beginning how I realized how difficult it was for you to get a clear concept of what is the human psyche. And so this is widespread. Most of us maybe know more about the moon and more about the sun and the outside, but they do not know very much about the inner world, yeah, the inner cosmos. And this is, for me, also a starting point, yeah? A starting point to make human beings aware of the inner cosmos, and teaching children as soon as possible, what is your inner cosmos? What is your feelings in compare? What is your memories? What is your I? And so on, so that they learn how do we think, how different ways are possible to think, and so on. With the progress of life, then you can even be more sophisticated, give more information. But in the end, then you have people who know that the inner world is something very, very precious, that you have to take care for it and not ignore it. There's so many people still, and it's quite some men also, yeah, they totally, completely ignore what's going on inside them. They do not want to know. They say, this is female stuff, psychology. I'm a man, I do something, I act something, I make decisions. And to reflect on this, what's going on? Well, how was my childhood? I do not like, it's female stuff, they can do it, but I do not like to do it, yeah? And to go away from this craziness, yeah, that you ignore yourself, that you ignore your psyche, and take it serious. And so I'm offering in my office here in Munich, I'm offering special man group, yeah, the coming together 50, 60 men and doing processes and slowly starting and say, okay, I see I'm a man, but I'm an empathetic being. I see other men, how empathetic they can be. Yeah. And when the women, we have also women in those groups, they see the men, say, for the first time, I realized that also men can be emotional. Yeah, that the first time in their life, yeah, they see, they have the impression that not only them as females they are emotional, but men are also emotional. Yeah, and this is something for me that is very important to make my knowledge available for as many people as possible in the world in different languages. What is the human psyche? What is this all about? And if we do know this, then we know how precious this is, that your life does not, in the end, not really depend on money. Yeah, you can have as much money you have, but if your psyche is not in order, if your psyche is traumatized, you are not at all, the rest of your life, not happy, even if you have millions of dollars. You see, there are so many examples for that. And that then the society is not built on how to produce more money and how to produce more goods and how to produce more new cars or more new computers or whatever. But the society that looks, how can we make people happy in this way that they have a healthy psyche? What can we do for a healthy psyche?
Would you say that you've observed something in the society at large that corresponds with what you observe in the individual? For example, that when you see in an individual that because of trauma, there's been this dissociation and this separation off into the mind or the ego that's driven to achieve mm-hmm. things and to please others or have control over others. You can see that in an individual, that they split off and they kind of disown and even oppress a whole part of themselves. Would you say that you can extend that outward to the whole of humanity, in that humanity as this collective organism has fragmented so that one part is overemphasized and a whole other much larger part is kind of oppressed and disowned and exploited.
For me, the society is just a compilation of individuals, of thinking persons, yeah? That is, you know, the family are father, mother, child, and the school is a teacher with 20 or 40 children, and the company is a leader with 500 workers, and the state is a president, and let's say five million inhabitants, like in Norway or in Austria. So this is, there is, for me, there's nothing like something that is more than that. Yeah, it is, if you change, in a way, the small society where you live in changes. Yeah? If you change in a couple relationship, then this couple relationship changes. And if your leader, the leader of a community, the teacher changes, then the children can change. And the same, if your political leaders somehow, they change, yeah, then the whole society can change. So this is, it depends on the inner structures. And I one of my principles is to say, if you are in peace with yourself, then the environment you live, you create around yourself, is in peace. If you are in war with yourself, you create an environment of war around yourself. That is something I think it's also important that if you, it's not necessary to wait until this society become improves or this society will change and then you can be happy. No, start with yourself. Start with yourself. Be for yourself the society you like to live in, because there is a relationship between you and you. Yeah? Mm. And if this relationship you have with yourself, yeah, is improved, if you step out of this blitz that are caused by trauma, then you are with yourself in peace and you are in a good society. This is the best way to create around yourself the society you like to live in. And I see it also from my experience, there is a principle of resonance. Sure. You get the resonance from the outside that is yours. That means if you are in peace with yourself, you are attractive for others who also like to be in peace for themselves and like to be in a to work together in a corporate way. If you are in war with yourself, you are attracted by those who go in resonance with your fighting. And then you have all times enemies around you. So this is for me very important that we are not getting lost somehow, yeah, by the idea, oh my God, everybody is traumatized and since centuries we are traumatized and already 1,000 years ago people did traumatize each other. That's true. But there's another truth. All traumatized human beings, they still have healthy parts. They still have left over healthy parts of their psyche. And you know, this is my basic model. I don't know if you have read it in a book or seen it in a book already. This is this big smiley, the big smiley that then splits when you are traumatized in three different parts. The traumatized part, yeah, on the one side, with maybe a lot of rage and anger and shame and pain. And this counterpart, what I call the surviving parts, that tries to ignore, to suppress, to push away the traumatized part, to keep it out of memory. And then there's still the healthy psyche. There's still a healthy psyche if you are maybe have the opportunity, you are in a healing circle, for example, then this healthy parts have a chance to show up, to take over the lead again. Otherwise, always your surviving parts are taking the lead. And then you have the possibilities. And this is what I'm doing in my therapy groups. I'm mostly working with groups, like doing group work. And what I first create is a space, a safe space, a welcoming place where you healthy part is invited to come and to show and to come out from the background. to the foreground. Yeah. And then, yeah, doing the work, and every work you do strengthens your healthy part again. And the, your surviving strategies over the time more and more lose their power, and more realize they are no longer needed. You can create safety on a different way, yeah, relying on your healthy parts. And then in the end also can go into contact with those traumatized parts that were left back in your biography and collect them and bring them together with your healthy parts. So in the end, the purpose and the aim is to become a non-fragmented human being and with a non-fragmented psyche. This is what I'm doing and doing for myself, and also supporting others to follow this path.
Heaven's a ghost town this time of year. Got a room on the river, got our hands on some local beer, and counted the gods. One on Chaplin and another on the bridge, three in the tunnel and more on the island in love. We knew religion,
seems the group thing is really central here. I mean, you said it started for you with the family constellations, which I've done some of these, and I mean there's quite a mysterious element to that which perhaps we can get into, but the main thing I wanted to bring up here is this the possibility that we can start to experience ourselves as nested or embedded in a support system, a support network of other consciousnesses, whether it's community, whether it's our ancestors, whether it's our family, whether it's humanity as a whole, that there is this possibility, if we start to relax and open up and feel the resonance around us, to experience ourselves not as isolate individuals who are fighting for survival, but like cells in a body or neurons in a brain that are in a cooperative system and that are continuously being supported and fed and nourished, but also having that responsibility to others.
Mm. Yes.
So I mean, I guess the central question around that is this idea we have of ourselves as isolate individuals seems to be itself symptomatic of trauma.
Absolutely. I fully agree with that you say now, yeah.
Mm. So, I mean, I don't want to bring us back to this, the mystery of the psyche, in such a way that, you know, you say that I'm being wishy-washy. I don't want to be wishy-washy at all, but there is this aspect of existence which is mysterious, at least because of these isolate identities, trauma-based identities. We can't perceive it, and we could say it's a spiritual dimension if we want to use that word, or just existential. I mean, the true nature of existence, which is we're all interconnected, and it seems as though those interconnections transcend space and time, insofar as in family constellations, for example, we find that we are able to tune into each other's ancestors and to bring things into resolution that are in the distant past. So, I mean, that's not really a question, but I guess my question is how do you explain that? Do you try to explain it, or is it just something that is purely experiential?
Yeah, on the one hand, it's really purely experimental. You know, I have developed my method like this. I call it intention method. And I offer my people I'm working with, I offer them, you can have whatever intention you have, please write it down, please make a drawing, please make it visible somehow. And then pick out of it maximum three words, so maximum three elements of drawing. And then choose, if I do group work, choose out of the group three people. For each of your element of the intention, you choose a person. And then this person goes into resonance with that. And the astonishing, absolutely astonishing and miracle thing, yeah, would you say it's a miracle, is that they really, without knowing anything about this other person, they mirror something, they resonate something, but this person say, yes, that's absolutely how it is for me. That's absolutely how I feel. This exactly how it I experience myself. And this is absolutely astonishing. Mm. Yeah. And now in this time of this corona pandemic, yeah, I have to do more online work, and I started with group work online, and it's the same. It works. It works even on the screen. Yeah, it's not necessary that you and me are in the same room and physically there, but it also works on the virtual, yeah, somehow in the virtual world. So this is very astonishing. And I, of course, I have my ideas about that, yeah, but I would not say I really fully can explain it, but somehow it seems to do with sending information, and also on an unconscious level, we send information and exchange information, and on a subconscious level, we exchange information. Now in the moment, then we exchange this verbally, it's a more conscious exchange of information, but there are much more exchange of information between two organisms, two persons, and that we would expect it. And yeah, and so I have a very simple model. Say I'm a sender, you're a receiver, and if I send something and allow you to receive something from myself, I open it up, I send you packages of information like on a computer, then you, if you are willing and prepared and say, okay, I do you the favor, I receive your packages of information, I reflect it back to you, then it works. So this is a simple model I have, but of course, how it really is and how it really works, maybe on a physical level with waves, what type of waves are this, I do not know. This is only you can find out if you would do experiments and try out what type of information transfer it is and whatnot. So that is not my, in the end, it's not my duty. Maybe others could do it who like to go into more details about this transference of and resonance of information.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's not really my field too. But, and it may be that it's kind of moot, because if one is starting to experience it, then perhaps one has less and less of a need to try and... you know.
Yeah, this is like for me. I know it, that it works, and it works worldwide. If I go to Brazil and do the same for the first time with the people, tell them about my method and tell them, go into resonance with this word and that word, it works. I go to Russia, the same. I go to Singapore, and it works. Yeah, as I say, so this is very astonishing. Sometimes when I go to some new places or have new groups, I'm in the for the years when I started like this, I was, oh my God, does it really work now in Spain too as it worked in Switzerland? But it does, yeah, with different languages, different people, it works. So I trust on it, and I do not doubt it, because I have thousands of experiments that show that it's valid. It's not a fake that is taking place here.
Yeah, I think one of the mysteries is that it's a mystery at all to us, this phenomenon, if it's innate to human organisms, that we transmit and receive information, experience, through resonating. And because I experience it, what we all do, but I mean, I've become more conscious of it doing this podcast, that there's a way to do it that is, that works better, and there's a way that works not so well. And it's a big part, is so much of it is just relaxing and listening and receiving what the other person's saying, and not having a list of questions, or not trying to keep have control over what happens. But there's always a risk there that, when there's an opening, my brain will just, it won't go back online, right? So it's like trying to find that balance of being, functioning. I guess it's left brain, right brain, very much. But if I had to reduce it to a formula, it's very much just relax and perceive.
Be open. Yeah, be
Yeah,
open.
be as open as possible.
Being open as possible, and this is one of the qualities of a healthy psyche. While our surviving strategy psyche tries to have control, tries to avoid information that maybe remember you on something that is unpleasant, remembers you something that could have happened in your childhood and what was traumatizing and painful for you. And this is a different state. Yeah, so you have a good communication with somebody and you have really a learning process with another person, it is necessary to go out of this surviving strategy psyche and come onto the healthy part of your psyche. And then then something happens, what I call co-consciousness. Then some consciousness. Then I contribute something to you and you contribute something to me. In the end, we are richer than we have been before in a way of having developed our psyche, having developed our consciousness, and even enrich, and this enriches our life.
It seems that that depends on not having a too much of a preconception about what it is that we want to get or find or know or discover. It's really, that's the openness, isn't it? Just coming in and,
This is what already John Bowlby told us. He said, or the people who are doing this research on bonding and attachment, they said, if the child feels safe with the mother, they know that the mother is available whenever I need her, she is available for me. Then these children, they explore. And they explore in a free way. If their children, they are not safe, they have not safe bonding with the mother, if they are not sure if the mother is there or if the mother leaving or if the mother is angry when I'm coming, and so, then these children are very hesitant, to explore their environment, to go away from the mother. They always have minimum half of their attention is with the mother. And so if you feel safe with the mother, then you can somehow put for the moment 100% of your attention to play what you're playing, you're exploring, and then if it's enough, you go back 100% to your mother. And this other children who have we call unsafe bonding, ambivalent bonding, avoiding bonding structure, then there's even if they are in making playing or playing with other children, a lot of their energy still is concerned with the mother. What is my mother? How is she? How is she? Or for example, is my mother ill? Or is she angry? Or something like this. And this makes you, not open.
So that seems as though, I mean, I've used the term mother possessed because it's in the movie Psycho, but that if a child, and I certainly was one of those children, grows up in that environment of constant anxiety around the mother's presence or her gaze or her emotional state, and it would have started for me in the womb, my mother was an alcoholic and quite depressed, then that imprints us from the start, and we may never get free of the mother's gaze in that way. Like everything we're doing unconsciously, we're trying to placate or get validation from our mothers, even right through to old age. Are you familiar with neoteny?
Not really. Tell me.
It just remind me what you were saying there about the child being able to play. Not needs to do with brain development, and so humans are more neotenous than other animals, which means that it takes we our childhood is much longer, so it means we're in a much longer period of brain development. And the way that the brain develops is through play. So the longer childhood we have, the more we can develop our deepen our awareness by developing our brain. So what you're describing there is children whose natural neoteny gets shut down. They lose the ability to just play, and so their brains can't develop in a natural way.
Very often in my, if we're doing this work, this resonance work, very often then parts show up that they, I want to play. Yeah, that means they were stuck in the development of the child. They were stuck in this state of development that they wanted to play, but they couldn't, huh? Because they were, as you said, too much concerned with their mothers or with their fathers.
Yeah, so then back to the competition thing. I mean, I was saying that competition can be good if it's a game, if it's playful. But what you're describing or diagnosing is a kind of competition that's not at all playful. Like it's just absolutely driven by survival needs, or even neurotic, survival needs.
For example, if our economic system, this economic system that is about money and who earns the money, and it's a competitive system, and there's also this competitive system between the nations, when, for example, when Donald Trump says America first, what does it mean? It does it mean that you have, say, there's a competition, we want to be first and you are second. And this is true somehow with most nations. We have 193 nations in the world, and the closer they are, the more they are neighbors, somehow the more they are enemies. Yeah, and having some struggles about some islands or struggles about the borders and so. And this is something I also would like that we as human being overcome. Yeah, that we say no. It's of course we some groups live here and other groups live here. But don't see the other groups as your enemies, and don't see them as somebody who has you have to fight against, and somebody who have is only you can be happy if the other nation is unhappy. So I think there's somehow, if you look at children, and there's some research on that, children are cooperative, yeah. And if you give children and teach children cooperative games, then they like it. They very much dislike at the beginning of their life, they very much dislike a game where the one wins and the other loses. Well, then they rather like to lose also in order not to blame the other one. Yeah. But in our competitive society, with this competitive school system, yeah, where you say, okay, you have to have good grades in order to progress, and then that means there are some of you can't progress. Then if you bring children under these conditions, then of course they have to forget about their innate tendency of cooperativeness, and then you give them these competitive games. And in school, if you have for example, a classwork, it's competitive, yeah. And bring and put them all under the condition of competition, that in the end, when they are grown up, when they are have their school degrees, have their master degree, whatever, then they believe they never have done anything else than competition. But that's not true. No? They have forgot about their innate cooperative nature. Yeah? And so it's dependent on society. If you force your next generation under the condition of a competition in school, or sometimes already in the kindergarten, then your mother says, "Oh, look, dear John, Michael already can calculate, and you can't," and so on, yeah. And you try to before people's children are going to school, that they should learn a second language, and so on, yeah, to prepare your child for competition. But this is, yeah, it's society. And this can be changed, of course, or could be changed.
I think part of it occurred to me as you're speaking there is there's a homogenization as well. So this idea that everybody has to excel in the same way. So everybody's got to be good at the same things, and so then that creates the competitive thing. But that also is a result of losing the idea of collaboration, which is you actually need different abilities and different skills, and you need to find out what each individual is good at and how that can be drawn out through that interactive cooperation, which is collaborative teamwork essentially. And it's like we live in a world, on the one hand, where teamwork has become almost impossible because of this competitive thing, but at the same time, it's more and more institutions and organizations and large corporations and collectives where teamwork is more and more essential, right? Because we're more aware of being in this huge collective.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when I was more in my competitive status years ago, and I met some people, and some people you would say, oh, these are losers. They are loser in society. They did not somehow make career in someone. And my experience is, these people, when I cooperate with them, they absolutely show some fantastic capacity and abilities. And I'm somehow over years we work together, and I benefit so much from them. But the first moment, I was thinking, ah, okay, this is a person that makes troubles, and this is a person that is not smart somehow. But in the end, it turned out these people have very specific qualities, yeah, that other people don't have. And so this is what you say. I agree. Every one of us has a specific quality, and if you bring out this specific quality to the outside, bring it out in bring it in into relationships, that is fantastic. It's a fantastic enrichment of our life. Every one of us can somehow, with his qualities, his specific quality, enrich your life. But if you force this person doing something that is not your his or hers, yeah, then this person makes a lot of troubles and produces a more of mess around this, yeah. But if you live in accordance with your abilities and capacities, then you're a source of wealth that you are producing.
Consuming some water while we're spoiling the rest. More thirsty than ever, but we do try our best. We are building our temples in great concrete walls. The higher the better, it's for the sake of us all.
Oh,
occurring to me as well, this competitive thing is almost a disguise for something much worse than competitive. It's conflict, isn't it? So what you're talking about with the nations, we could see it more clearly with nations that they're warring and they're for power, you know, they're jockeying for power. But with individuals as well, like even you and I, because we have our traumatic imprints, as you were saying earlier, there are things we don't want to see, particularly about ourselves. So whenever we engage with the dialogue with the other, there's always a danger that we will see something about ourselves that we don't want to see, and that might be experienced as weakness. So then there's a compensatory tendency to try and maintain control over the exchange in such a way that will prevent that from happening. And really that becomes about trying to dominate the other. It may be very subtle, but see what I'm getting at. It's really, it's there in every individual human interaction that we see each other as potential threats.
Yeah, the biggest problem I see if people run away from themselves, because then they not only run away from themselves, but that means doing harm to themselves, but they also do harm to others then by running away from themselves.
Well, it's a fight or flight, isn't it? As well. It's not necessarily either or, is it? It's fight and flight, a combination of both. I wanted to actually go a little bit into some darker stuff before we wind up. I was also curious about if you're familiar with a couple of authors. Just this is not really leading to a discussion, but I did want to introduce them to you if you don't. One is Donald Cowshed, who wrote Inner World of Trauma.
I didn't hear.
I think you might get something. I found that book enormously useful. He's a psychotherapist, and the book is about his different case studies, experiences he's worked with. And
where does he live?
He's in the US somewhere, I forget where exactly. But yeah, he helped me enormously to understand the way that the trauma, the psyche fragments, and the different coping mechanisms, very similar to your model, I think, with the three parts. The other is Lloyd DeMouse. Do you know him?
This person I know, yeah.
Yeah, because he has the same view that you've expressed, that we need to provide safe spaces for our mothers. If anything's going to change, not our mothers, but the mothers in society. I just wanted to mention those two. The question I had, or what I thought we could go into briefly before we wind up, is this reality that we're in, a social reality, which is superficial perhaps compared to the deeper reality of the psyche and all that, but it's still very real, is this trauma-based world that functions in a certain way to perpetuate the trauma. And one of the ways that is observable is that there's an intentional aspect to it. There are philosophies, methodologies, groups and individuals who intentionally traumatize individuals and societies in order to maintain power. There's even something that I don't know if you're familiar with, that it's become quite insidious. There's a belief out there that I've been mapping for a while, that trauma is good for us, that trauma can help us to evolve, that trauma can make us more enlightened and more aware. I think it's very insidious and insane, but there's a lot of people advocating this idea. So I just wondered how much you've mapped that or traced that or have an awareness of that there is this very dark conscious element to applying trauma to individuals and society.
Of course. This darkness of a consciousness, the belief in the belief in the evil and the belief that the evil is the good one, for me an extreme way of surviving strategy, and if you would trace it back in these people who have these belief systems, of course, they have had already in the womb was hell for them, no? And how they experienced their time in mother's womb must have been hell for them, yeah. And similar than the birth processes and the way of being brought up and they were treated. I'm sure if you, whenever I have people in my groups, they are like this, because of course those extremists, they are not going to these groups. Yeah, this is a pity. they should go to this. But somehow you see there, if the people are coming and they see their mothers and fathers behaving like this psychopath, as you mentioned it, no? Then of course you know that they themselves have had very, very bad childhood experiences that made them like this, yeah, and that make them to take refuge to this surviving types. Yeah. I don't know if you have read in my book "Who Am I in a Traumatized and Traumatizing Society?" It's case studies of Anders Behring Breivik from Norway, who was a mass killer on this island of Utøya. Yeah, he killed 77 young people and had a bomb in Oslo. And if you know his biography, how his mother was traumatized, his mother tried to get rid of him and so on, then it's very clearly why he becomes such a dark person, a dark-minded person. Somehow on the one thing, believing in power and white power and whatever crude fantasies he has, but inside himself there's still this vulnerable child, yeah, who seeks for attention, who seeks for being acknowledged and so on. This, you have always both, yeah. You're having this Hitler in a way, yeah, who was also like a person like this. And if you look at this biography, you see how it came. Because in Hitler's case, it was like this, that he is the fourth child of his mother. And before him, in between two weeks, three of his siblings were dying, yeah, because of diphtheria. And 14 months after this very terrible event for his mother, that losing, imagine how it is for a mother to lose all her three children in 2 weeks, yeah, horrible. And this mother conceives very early, let's say after four months or 5 months already, conceives another child. That again shows how Hitler's father didn't have any respect for his wife and using her as a sex object, and then Hitler was born. And looked, and inside the mother's womb already had this darkness, yeah, of this death of these siblings. And afterwards, his mother always were looking at him as if he's also could also die early and so on. And the mother's eyes are full of trauma. Then you can understand why Hitler became the person he became. Yeah. And even worse, his younger brother, he had a brother afterwards, he died again when he was 6 years old, yeah, from an appendix problem. Mm-hmm. So Hitler was surrounded by death, and somehow he reproduced this, producing death around him, yeah? Because his mother was death. His feeling from his mother was the feeling of death, and somehow you could say he felt home with death. Mm. His mother feeling was death, and then he produced death and felt in death, felt home, felt connected with his mother. There's always a reason, no? There's always a reason why people become so extreme, people become so black, and in every case you could, of course, and then these dark conscious people, they resonate with each other, and they come together, and maybe they build alliances and so on. Yeah.
Yes, well, that was what I was asking about. And I mean, one of the obstacles to healing, as you said, it's very essential that we become aware of the nature of the trauma and the nature of the psyche, and just start looking at it. Maybe that's almost everything that needs to happen. Things change from there. And one aspect of that, for me at least, has been looking at the nature of society, the hidden aspects of society. And you may be aware there's quite a lot of testimonials out there in literature and the rest of it about MK Ultra, trauma-based mind control, satanic or otherwise ritual abuse. These things are, in my view, they're absolute realities, but they're definitely being represented in ways that often discredit them. Like I don't know about the majority, but an awful lot of people still consider these things simply untrue and impossible.
It's too shocking. Yeah, it's too shocking for many people that they could believe that this is can be a reality, and it would blow their mind and would blow their imagination about the world is and how human beings are. But one of the advantages of trauma, of course, then you see these very terrible things. But the moment when you can explain it and can understand it, how this is the way people develop such a darkness in their mind because of their own trauma, and then they traumatize others, I feel it's very helpful. And then you have not, with the trauma knowledge, a trauma-based knowledge you have, it helps you so much to deal with reality. Then you don't have to shut out realities that exist.
It does have to be incremental, I think, doesn't it? Because as people do see too much, if any of us see too much reality too soon, then we withdraw and we shut down. So I think, I think the nature of society, the way it's been configured over the centuries, is such that it's a society that's shaped by trauma, and that because of that, it's a society that is inherently traumatizing in ways that are quite systematized and organized. And if we start to see them, it would seem very much as though we were embedded in this malevolent social system. I believe that we are embedded in a malevolent social system. But like you, I also say, well, these are traumatized individuals, so it doesn't help to demonize. But I guess I'm just bringing it up because I feel that one of the things I try to do with my work is to bridge two worlds. One is, in this case, your world, I mean, you've done some serious research into trauma. You've developed a platform of respectable research and applied healing and all the rest of it. And then there's also all of these people who are floundering around in a certain sense, too much knowledge about the nature of the world and what it's like, and being overwhelmed by that, and at the same time that's being discredited. So somehow I'm looking for ways to bridge in such a way that the nature of the world can be perceived in a way that isn't sensationalized and isn't overly, I think, because it can be traumatizing. Even too much truth can be traumatizing in itself, or re-traumatizing, I think. So I guess that's why I'm bringing it up. And I mean, do you have experience with people who are victims of that kind of malevolence, would you say?
Some I have, and I have colleagues that do have women, especially women that come out of this, what is called satanic circle, or this pedophile rings, or who sell these children. And so this we do have some. And there was a phase in my life when many of those people come to me, and then I realize it's too much. I can't handle it. I think every psychotherapist only can handle a few of them. A few of them, these very, very severely traumatized individuals who are traumatized by these circles, these dark circles. But you can't. There's one lady in Germany, Michaela Huber, is one of or a few. There's just a few who really specialized on working with these people. Yeah, and they have gained a lot of insight in that, have written books about this. I don't know if you know the literature about Michaela Huber, for example.
No.
That might be translated into English also. But she gained a lot of insight because she had a lot of clients that are coming out of this background. And yeah, I have a colleague in Norway too. So if you're looking for contact, That's my colleague in Oslo, Martha Torsheim, who has also gained some insight in this group of people who are living in this adoring and worshipping the evil.
Well, yes, perhaps. I would certainly be interested in looking at their work. I mean, I myself, I'm trying to take my attention more on lighter areas, but at the same time, I don't want to be turning away from people, you know, areas that most need attention. It's really about finding the balance, like you're saying. If one takes on too much, then one becomes overwhelming. And my sense really with this is that it's very much a spectrum, and that we're all on it. So at one end you've got the extreme, whether it's the extreme perpetrator of Adolf Hitler or the extreme victims of organized malevolence that you were describing there, and the other end you've got people who dodged quite a lot of bullets, but they were still born into a culture that itself is inherently traumatic and traumatizing. I feel like it's through the media and the entertainment and the political figures and the systems. It just seems all pervasive. So that's been my approach. I mean, and you talk about how important the biography is, and my approach has been to, I suppose, juxtapose what I can see in the world and in the culture with my own biography, and map the intersection there, and it's helped me to actually uncover the shape of trauma in my own past that I can't consciously remember, because it's like the body throws up many clues, you know, to what's in there that our minds won't allow.
Yeah, it's important, and it goes hand in hand. The more you become conscious about your own trauma biography, you clearer can see what's going on the outside, and so this really goes also with me, goes hand in hand. And I'm still working on my own trauma biography, because I didn't have a very pleasant uprising. I was not wanted as a child, and so on, and I nearly died 4 times before my first year. And so slowly getting access to this darkness of my own early childhood helps me a lot to get clear what's going on outside too in this society.
I think we covered quite a lot. I have to go quite soon, so is there anything else you wanted to get into before we close up?
No, I'm just one of those listeners who listen to us, that really to say, be open for reality, for the outside reality, for the inner reality. And there's always something inside you that is worth to contact. And if you find this point of reference inside you, then you can make a very big shift towards a better life. And what maybe I tell something about my international conference I'm offering in this year, online, as a live online conference, from the 16th to 18th of October 2020. Because of the corona pandemic, we switched from a live conference to a live online conference, and now we can offer more participants take place, because our venue was limited to 500, and now we can open to more participants. So if some of our listeners want to participate in this live online congress, feel free to go to our webpage, www.healthy-autonomy.de, and you find a way to apply for this conference. And then you can learn a lot more about my thinking. I give lectures there, and we do workshops there, and we have discussions there. So if you are interested now in learning more about my theory, or learning more about my practice, that could be a good option this year in October to participate in this live online congress.
So is that just you, or is it several other speakers?
No, a lot of you. There's a lot of speakers, and we have over these three days, we offer 40 workshops, 40 workshops with practice. And if and I offer this because I learned to do it online online therapy and online group therapy, and it's also maybe interesting to experience this, how this can really work.
Will family constellations be part of it?
I started with family constellation, then I continued with trauma constellation, then I continued with the constellation of the intention, and now I call my approach identity oriented, yeah, where the family in the family constellation to have the family, the system in the focus. And when I work now, I have the identity, you, the person I work with, in the focus. And there is a shift of the focus from family to identity. Of course, you're part of the family, you're part of a relationship, but the focus is not the family, but in the system, the focus is on identity. So this is a shift I made over these 25 years of development of my own theory and of my own practice. So it's, you can say it's something new. In compare, it has his roots in the back in the family constellation, but now I have, I would say it's something outstanding and extra, and something has an extra focus.
And your men's group, is that open to newcomers?
It's in German.
Oh, it's in German. Okay.
German, so if you,
I don't probably have thinking, too many.
Yeah, I'm thinking about now with this online possibilities, I'm thinking really, because I was asked by other men from different countries if I could offer an international man group, and this then I would offer it in English. So if I have free space and see how it goes on now, I would like to offer also an international English speaking man group. Yeah.
I think there's probably a demand for it. So if you do, let me know, and I can link it.
Yes.
Even later on, I can link
yeah,
it at this
I'll do.
Podcast.
I'll do. In the moment, we have this main group once a month in Germany for one day.
Right.
In Germany.
Good. Well, thanks, Franz. I'm glad we managed to stay awake for this one.
Funny, you fall asleep, I fall asleep.
Oh, I would have fallen asleep if I'd known that you were going to fall asleep. I was thinking, oh God, I'd just love to just stay here in the sun and sleep. No, I've got an interview. So it's funny, if I'd been more in tune, I would have let myself fall asleep.
It was so funny, because yesterday I wake up very early. I have written an article because I had it in my mind. I went up and then I had did a lot of things during the day, and then After the lunch, at the dinner in the evening, I said to my wife, "Okay, now I rest for 15 minutes. I have an interview." Fall asleep, and when I wake up, it was 12 o'clock already.
She let you sleep. That's nice.
So,
of her.
Sorry for missing this day.
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah. It worked out. All's well that ends well. That's the end of that conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as I did. For more about Franz, click on the link in the show notes. And I hope you will consider supporting this podcast, or most specifically, if you haven't already, 16 Maps of Hell, with a rough draft of The Exit, The Unraveling of Hollywood Superculture. The campaign is currently up to £5,555.07. We're on the homeward stretch. So if you listen to this podcast and you have not donated, that's odd. I mean, I think I have a few hundred listeners. So stop freeloading. You get this podcast for free. Maybe you also donate and contribute to the podcast, in which case, consider yourself exempt from this. But anyway, back to those freeloaders who aren't or haven't contributed to 60 Maps of Hell. You should be ashamed. If you enjoy this podcast, then that's the way to show it, because that's currently what I'm working on. And as I say, I don't charge for the podcast, and I have no intention of. Someday I'll stop podcasting, of course, but I don't think I'll ever start charging. But this book does need your support if it's going to happen. So get out your checkbook, your pencil and your pen, and click on the PayPal link. And thanks for listening, and thanks in advance for doing that. I know you will. Next week's podcast is with a very interesting listener called Tim K. Bye for now. Change with the times, strangers in the night.